evil of the retreating whisperer, who whispers evil into the breasts of mankind, from among the jinn and mankind.
In the limelight.
Facebook and Instagram have zero credibility and have proven time and time again that their priority is profiting off their manipulative and addictive tactics to keep users scrolling. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett, writer. This article is published under the heading Health Advocates Urge Facebook to Scrap Plan to Build Instagram for Kids 12 and Under. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A coalition of 36 organizations and 64 experts in child development and the impact of technology sent a letter on Thursday, April 15th, to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, discouraging the ongoing development of an Instagram specifically designed for children ages 12 and under. Facebook acquired the photo and video sharing social media platform for $1 billion in 2012. Both Facebook and Instagram are officially restricted to users ages 13 and older, which traces back to the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, reporting last month that an Instagram for kids was, in the earlier stages of development, provoked fierce criticism from parents and advocates, including leaders at Amnesty Tech and Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, CCFC. The new letter to Zuckerberg was written and organized by CCFC, which has also launched a petition urging Facebook to refrain from targeting children with a new platform and instead invest in educating parents that Instagram isn't for kids and identifying and closing accounts of young people who have lied about their ages. It is beyond cynical that Instagram is using its failure to comply with the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act and its failure to protect kids as an excuse to target younger children, said CCFC Executive Director Josh Gollin in a statement. Instagram's business model relies on extensive data collection, maximizing time on devices, performing a culture of oversharing and idolizing influencers, he noted, as well as a relentless focus on often altered physical appearance, and it is certainly not appropriate for seven-year-olds. James P. Steyer, founder and CEO of Common Sense, one of the groups that signed on to the letter, concurred. As he put it, Facebook has gone back to their old bag of tricks, coming up with another product designed to get kids hooked when they are at their most vulnerable. While teens online deserve safe and protected environments, Facebook and Instagram have zero credibility and have proven time and time again that their priority is profiting off their manipulative and addictive tactics to keep users scrolling, Steyer said. What Mark Zuckerberg should do instead of targeting young customers is take the billions of dollars Facebook reaps every year from amplifying harmful content and instead invest in making a healthy and privacy-protective product for adults. other signatories include Accountable Tech, Africa Digital Rights Hub, Australian Council on Children and Media, Berkeley Media Studies Group, Center for Health Science and Law in Canada, Child Online Africa, Consumer Action, Consumer Federation of America, Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, Every Child Protected Against Trafficking UK, Network for Public Education, Norwegian Cancer Society, Public Citizen, and Reset Australia. Individuals who endorsed the letter include University of St. Gallen Professor Veronica Barassi, author of Child Data Citizen, Patrick Burton, Executive Director of the Center for Justice and Crime Prevention in South Africa, and co-author of various studies. Psychologist Richard Fried, author of Wired Child, Reclaiming Childhood in a Digital Age, and Susan Lin, a lecturer in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and author of Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood. The letter details concerns that an Instagram for kids would exploit rapid developmental changes children experience in the elementary and middle school years, highlights the growing body of research which demonstrates that excessive use of digital devices and social media is harmful to adolescents, suggests that children already on Instagram are unlikely to migrate to a babyish version of the platform, and notes Facebook's troubling track record when it comes to young people. In short, an Instagram site for kids will subject young children to a number of serious risks and will offer few benefits for families, the groups warn, pointing to a letter that Senators Ed Markey and Richard Blumenthal, as well as Representatives Katie Caster and Lori Trahan, sent to Zuckerberg recently. If Facebook's objective is to decrease the number of users under the age of 13 on its current Instagram platform, it should invest in efforts to do that directly, says the lawmaker's letter, also noting relevant studies and the company's record. The alternative approach that Facebook appears poised to take is specifically pushing kids to sign up for a new platform that may itself pose threats to young users' privacy and well-being, involve serious challenges, and may do more harm than good. The lawmakers requested a response from Facebook to 14 detailed questions about the company's Instagram for Kids work by April 26. Despite alarm among health advocates and lawmakers, Facebook doesn't seem inclined to drop the plan. According to New York Times, Stephanie Ottaway, a Facebook spokeswoman, said that Instagram was in early stages of developing a service for children as part of an effort to keep those under 13 off its main platform. Although Instagram requires users to be at least 13, many younger children have lied about their age to set up accounts. Ms. Ottaway said that company would not show ads in any Instagram product developed for children younger than 13, and that it planned to consult with experts on children's health and safety on the project. Instagram is also working on new age verification methods to catch younger users trying to lie about their age, she said. The reality is that kids are online, Ms. Ottaway said. They want to connect with their family and friends, have fun and learn, and we want to help them to do that in a way that is safe and age-appropriate. Signatory and American University Professor Emerita Catherine Montgomery, a senior strategist at the Center for Digital Democracy, which also signed on to the letter as an organization, said recently that Facebook claims that creating an Instagram for kids will help keep them safe on the platform. But the company's real goal is to expand its lucrative and highly profitable Instagram franchise to an even younger demographic, introducing children to a powerful, commercialized social media environment that poses serious threats to their privacy, health, and well-being, she said. Given his failures to protect the public from disinformation, hate speech, and manipulation, parents cannot trust Facebook promises to protect young children.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program.
Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. Cause Ramadan is here. Whoa, Ramadan is here.
Today's lesson. Classification of fast observers on the basis of their food consumption. The fast observers whose eating and drinking is provided through forbidden means are like the ones who carry the burden of things belonging to others upon their shoulders. The things ultimately reach their owner, and the exhaustion and fatigue remain with these people. The reward of fast of such fast observers is given to the real owners of those eatables or drinks which were illegally consumed by these fast observers. And for them, nothing remains except tyranny, wrath, and usurpation of people's wealth. Or they are like those who undertake pilgrimage to Mecca riding upon a usurped animal, in which case the reward of the Hajj pilgrimage reaches to the owner of that animal, and exhaustion and fatigue remain for the usurper. Brothers and sisters, it's important for us to not fool ourselves. Sometimes we try to outsmart Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala without knowing that we are doing this or without realizing that we are doing this. Allah is the knower of hearts. He knows where your food is coming from. He knows the money you spent on buying your groceries, whether it belongs to someone else or this money belongs to you. So if you are keeping a fast, your family is keeping a fast, you bring in groceries, which is with the usurped wealth, well, guess what? You're in serious trouble. So be very careful of what you consume and where you bring it from.
Ramadan al-mustabin jaa bin nur al-mubin. Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan al-qanitin.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the classification of fast observers on the basis of their food consumption. The fast observers whose eating and drinking consists of doubtful material, that their being lawful, which is halal, or unlawful or forbidden, which is haram, is not confirmed. You know, something that is in the middle, you know, it's not confirmed, it's not for sure, it's a doubtful consumption or food material, could be further classified into two groups. The first group consists of those fast observers, whereby the consumption of such eating and drinking items apparently is lawful or halal for them. The second group consists of those consumption of such eating and drinking items apparently is not halal or lawful for them. These people, with slight variation, are similar to those fast observers whose eating and drinking is provided by unlawful, which is haram, means. The fast observers whose eating and drinking consists of lawful means but are excessive in their consumption in quality as well as in quantity. That is, they fill their tablecloth with colorful, delicious dishes at dawn, which is suhoor, and at the time of fast breaking, which is iftar, and in their consumption of these foods indulge in overeating. Are we not seeing this phenomena very much alive in our societies today? There are those huge, big, fancy iftar parties, right, in Muslim communities. But nobody or very few people care to question whether what we're doing is the right thing or not, whether all this extravagance and spending so much extra on this iftar is right or not. What is the source of all this money that we're using to prepare this food for breaking our iftar? Something for you to ponder and think about.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past, when everything was going so fast, and now I just can't go on.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The United States announced last week its plan to withdraw all its troops from Afghanistan. In a White House speech, President Joe Biden said it was time to end Washington's longest war in history.
After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
Biden said the withdrawal will begin from May 1st and conclude by September 11 this year. Shortly after his announcement, NATO said in a statement that it will coordinate its troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan with the United States.
In the light of the U.S. decision to withdraw, foreign and defense ministers of NATO discussed the way forward today. I decided that we will start the withdrawal of NATO Resource Support Mission forces by May 1st.
The NATO chief said it is now up to the Afghans to reach sustainable peace. But the U.S. government has kept silent about whether it will also withdraw American private contractors conducting operations there.
So on the contractors, we don't know exactly. There's some preliminary plans. Clearly, the goal is to get all our personnel out, and I suspect that contractors will be part of that. Whether there'll still be a need for some contractor support, I just don't know. We don't have that level of detail right now. We're still working through that.
The New York Times has cited U.S. officials as saying that the U.S. is planning to continue its presence in Afghanistan by keeping the contractors and operatives in the country following the withdrawal of its troops.
Biden is trying to present himself as a new kind of president. And to do that, he has to make some pretend announcements that things are changing. This is one of them.
So why has the U.S. decided to pull out its forces if it's so keen on keeping its military presence there? Washington-linked private security companies have a long history of committing war crimes and interfering in countries around the world. Perhaps one of the most notorious of the American private contractors is Blackwater, now renamed Academy, which has been involved in several major scandals. The most notable was an incident in 2007 in Iraq when four Blackwater security personnel killed 14 civilians, two of whom children. Former U.S. President Donald Trump exacerbated this scandal by pardoning the contractors in his final days in office. But Blackwater is not the only such American firm that is active in conducting high-level overseas operations.
America has approximately 500 military bases around the planet. It has hundreds of major bases, and then it has hundreds of minor bases. So Afghanistan is just one peg in a worldwide network of military bases that the United States uses to put pressure on different regions to support its political, economic, and social goals as an empire.
Back in May 2020, Venezuela arrested 13 individuals charged with planning an operation in the capital, Caracas, two of whom were American nationals. The U.S. mercenaries admitted that they were arrested during a failed attempt to raid Venezuela's presidential palace and seize President Nicolas Maduro. Considering the controversy surrounding the presence of U.S. private security firms abroad, experts believe Washington seeks a lower level of accountability by reducing the number of its declared troops in countries like Afghanistan.
America is an empire. President Biden is the current administrator of that empire. There's a lot of opposition among the people of America to never-ending so-called forever wars.
What's certain is that the United States is unwilling to leave the region, no matter if that would translate into the privatization of its wars in West Asia.
On Saturday, diplomats from the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action agreed to continue the negotiations as well as technical consultations within the next days. At the end of the talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, Iranian chief nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi stressed that differences have not been settled yet. He reiterated that some serious disagreements need to be resolved during next negotiations. The senior Iranian diplomat's remarks were in line with what the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, previously said. The leader had earlier warned against protracted talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear accord. The leader has dismissed the proposals by the U.S. during the negotiations. Iran has made it clear that it will only return to its commitment under the accord once it has verified that all the imposed, reimposed, and relabeled U.S. sanctions against Tehran are removed. However, U.S. media have cited a source close to America's top nuclear negotiator, Robert Malley, in Vienna, as saying that Washington is opposed to the removal of all sanctions imposed on Iran. According to the article by the Foreign Policy magazine, Washington is willing to only remove sanctions outlining the nuclear deal, but sanctions not inconsistent with the JCPOA will remain in place. That would mean the United States is seeking to divide anti-Iran sanctions into removable, irremovable, and negotiable sanctions. However, that could strike a heavy blow against the talks in Vienna to revive the deal, as far as removal of all sanctions is the only way to salvage the negotiations from collapse.
I've read several instances in American mainstream media referring to Robert Malley's effort right now as trying to strike what they're referring to as a Goldilocks-style deal to return to the JCPOA. And what is meant by that is a deal that is neither too hot or too cold, that strikes some sort of balance or that is just right. The sanctions that the United States has placed on Iran are illegal under international law. It is a fact that they were purposefully muddled and conflated with terrorism to make their lifting more difficult. And so this is just going to be something that the United States government is going to have to work out to bring itself back into the compliance with the deal that it signed in 2015 and United Nations Resolution 2231.
Last week, the European Union sanctioned 8 Iranian commanders and 3 entities over so-called human rights violations. The move was a big shock for Tehran, as it is involved in EU-mediated talks to revive the JCPOA. Iranian chief nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi lashed out at EU sanctions, saying they have undermined the talks in Vienna.
And we told them that even your human rights sanctions that you imposed 2 days ago, we consider as JCPOA-related sanctions, because right in the middle of negotiations, you decided to impose sanctions. And that is certainly to undermine the current negotiations and to undermine JCPOA altogether. So as far as you are concerned, this is in fact a significant non-performance by European Union to impose new sanctions or new designations, as they call it.
Also, the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, slammed the EU for imposing sanctions on Iran instead of condemning America's economic terrorism against 82 million Iranians and the incident at Natanz nuclear facility.
This proves that the EU has no place in the world. It proves that not only the EU follows U.S. policies, but it also follows the most extremist groups inside the U.S. and Israel.
The top Iranian diplomat called the EU sanctions destructive, saying Iran will respond to this action by imposing bans on European individuals.
I think that the most recent round of sanctions applied by the EU to Iran are purely to be used as a bargaining chip in the current talks in Vienna. The EU has not placed sanctions on Iran since 2013, and so therefore this application of sanctions against members of Iran's military coming now right in the middle of these very tendentious talks within Vienna, albeit so far constructive, is a clear sign that the EU is once again fulfilling its role as a vassal entity for the United States.
On Friday, Tehran announced that it has increased its nuclear activities despite the sabotage attack, and its first batch of 60% enriched uranium was ready at Natanz nuclear facility. While the U.S. seems to try to use the sanctions and the acts of sabotage as leveraging the negotiations on the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran has taken back the momentum by making that announcement on Friday. Iran says it will not pay attention to Washington's rhetoric and that the ball is in the U.S. court to revive the deal, if it really wants to do so.
The United States under President Joe Biden has taken a tougher stance against Russia. On Thursday, Biden said Washington is facing a national emergency, accusing Russia of interference in the 2020 U.S. presidential election and involvement in a major cyber espionage operation. Biden signed an executive order imposing sweeping sanctions against several Russian individuals and institutions, requiring the Treasury Department to block U.S. financial institutions from purchasing bonds from the Central Bank of the Russian Federation, the National Wealth Fund of the Russian Federation, or the Ministry of Finance of the Russian Federation after June 14, and from lending funds to these institutions. Also, the U.S. said it's expelling 10 personnel from Russia's diplomatic mission, claiming that some of them are representatives of intelligence services. But at the same time, the U.S. president called for de-escalation with Russia.
The way forward is through thoughtful dialogue and diplomatic process. The U.S. is prepared to continue constructively to move forward that process. My bottom line is this. Where there's an interest in the United States to work with Russia, we should and we will. If Russia seeks to violate the interests of the United States, we will respond.
Shortly after the announcement, the North Atlantic Council, the political decision-making body within NATO, released a statement in support of the U.S. measures.
Well, it seems to me that it's more appropriate, and probably has been done, for the Russians to declare a national emergency, because they are the ones that are threatened, not the U.S. The U.S. is intervening in a crisis which it helped to create through the support given during the Obama years to the color revolution in Ukraine, which was directed primarily against Russia on behalf of the Western intelligence forces, who felt, in the words of Brzezinski, that if Russia loses Ukraine, they become very weak.
The developments come amid heightened tensions in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian forces and the Ukrainian military have clashed in recent weeks. Moscow said it will ban a string of top officials from U.S. President Joe Biden's administration, including his chief domestic policy advisor Susan Rice, from entering Russia. The Russian Foreign Ministry said U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, FBI Chief Christopher Wray, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and several other officials will be barred. The ministry said the officials participated in the anti-Russian push of the U.S. politics. The U.S. ambassador to Moscow is also being asked to leave the country.
President Vladimir Putin's top foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, has recommended that U.S. envoy John Sullivan leave for Washington to conduct serious consultations.
Lavrov said Russia would ask 10 U.S. diplomats to leave the country in a tit-for-tat move. He said the activity of American funds and NGOs in Russia that interfere in the country's internal affairs would also be seized. Lavrov added that Moscow is also considering, quote, painful measures against U.S. businesses in Russia.
The policy as it's now formed is aimed at really reducing Russia as a major power. They're doing it primarily economically, but also I think what they want is they will not accept a Russia led by Vladimir Putin, but they want regime change. So it's really to create a world in which the United States sets the rules.
It appears that the U.S. and Russia are heading towards another Cold War. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
The war in Afghanistan has been a major foreign policy challenge for several U.S. presidents. The war, which began in 2001 under former President George W. Bush, has killed some 2,300 U.S. troops and cost American taxpayers more than $2 trillion. The protracted conflict has been widely described as futile. This week, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that America will finally withdraw all of its forces from Afghanistan in 2021.
After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
Several thousand American forces remain part of the 9,600-strong NATO mission there. Under Biden's plan, the withdrawal is scheduled to begin on May the 1st and will be completed in September. The U.S. president seems confident about his withdrawal plan, but his initiative has been met with criticism. The Taliban called for the U.S. to abide by an agreement with the group, which was brokered in Doha, Qatar, last year. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump had agreed to pull out all troops from Afghanistan by May the 1st. The militant group warned that if the Doha agreement is breached, those who fail to comply with the deal will be held responsible for any possible problems. Russia's foreign ministry also said the newly announced withdrawal strategy violates America's previous promises. Meanwhile, the pullout plan comes at a time when Taliban militants are in control of large parts of Afghanistan after nearly two decades of the U.S.-led war against them. The almost 20-year war has wreaked havoc in Afghanistan and claimed tens of thousands of lives. Taliban militants who were forced out of power by the U.S. invasion in 2001 proved resilient and clawed back large parts of Afghanistan from foreign and government forces, especially in recent years. They are now in control of important parts of the country. They seem to be an indispensable part of Afghanistan's future. Critics of America's foreign policy say this exposes the futility of U.S. militarism in the region.
I believe that this conflict, when you analyze it, the only proper way to state it is that it was a total failure. The United States will try to spin this into a complicated story, into saying, you know, it's complicated, nobody, there are no clear winners. But you think about the fact that they did the same similar thing even in Vietnam, when the Americans were dealt a sound crushing defeat.
The U.S.-led military campaign failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with a long list of problems such as poverty, unemployment, and illicit opium production. Some even go so far as to call war-torn Afghanistan a failed state. Meanwhile, the insecurity has provided a fertile ground for the growth of militant groups more extreme than the Taliban. Now foreign forces are finally planning to leave. Who is responsible for the mess that they're leaving behind? It's the Afghan people who have to put up with the unending misery every day. The departure of foreign forces this year could mark a new chapter for Afghans. Observers believe Afghans across the country, whether in the ranks of the Taliban or the government, have to put aside their differences and work together if they really want a future for their country.
A 2020 study on how U.S. mass incarceration contributes to climate change found that increasing state-level incarceration rates between 1997 and 2016 were correlated with increases in industrial emissions and the use of toxic chemicals because of the expansion of industrial prison supply manufacturing operations. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Adam Mahoney Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Biggest County Jails Are Sites of Extreme Environmental Injustice. Stay tuned for more. For more than half a century, 441 Botches Street has been the address where Los Angeles' most stark social and environmental inequalities converge. It's the location of LA's Men's Central Jail, the largest facility in the most populated county jail system in the U.S. On any given day, about 5,000 people are incarcerated there. A block south from the jail is 101 Freeway, one of the most traveled highways in America, which generates dangerous levels of air pollution linked to a slew of birth defects. A block east is the LA River, home to at least 20 different pollutions, from faces to oil at levels that violate federal standards. Another 100 yards east is the SP Rail Yard and Union Pacific Transportation Center, which operate at all hours, receiving big rig diesel trucks that spew an estimated 40 tons of particulate matter into the air annually. According to data compiled by the Environmental Protection Agency's Environmental Justice Screening Tool, those detained inside Men's Central Jail are situated closer to toxic wastewater and hazardous waste than 96% of the country. Their lifetime cancer risk from inhalation of air toxics is in 100th percentile, meaning there is virtually no place in the U.S. where it's higher. Men's central proximity to extreme toxicity is an anomaly. A grist analysis of 11 jails in the three biggest county jail systems in America, Los Angeles, New York City, and Chicago, found that people residing within or surrounding eight of these facilities are in the 90th percentile or higher for pollution-related cancer risk, respiratory hazards, and diesel pollution exposure. Nine of the facilities are located closer to toxic wastewater than at least 97% in the country, and all 11 are in the 90th percentile or higher for proximity to hazardous waste. None of this is accidental. New York City's biggest jail, Rikers Island, was built on a former landfill. Now, its inmates reside in closer proximity to hazardous waste than 97% of Americans. Chicago's Cook County Jail, located in the middle of Little Village, one of the most polluted communities in America, is home to more diesel pollution than virtually anywhere else in the U.S. While former research on toxicity and prisons has typically focused on more permanent detention facilities, such as state prisons, little has been done around jails because they're seen as temporary holding facilities for people awaiting trial. But data show that it is common for some people, and particularly poor people, to spend months and sometimes years in county jails before ever being convicted of a crime. Cash bail requirements mean that people who can't afford to put up enough money to be released on bail are often effectively serving a sentence while nominally awaiting trial. For this reason, jails could be an emerging focus of environmental justice movement. This is because environmental justice advocates focus on so-called frontline communities, places that shoulder a disproportionate burden of a society's waste, contamination, and pollution. Louisiana Cancer Alley, for example, hosts many of the nation's petrochemical plants, and its majority black residents see the effects show up in their health. David Pello, director of the Global Environmental Justice Project at the University of California, Santa Barbara, argues that those incarcerated in county jails constitute a frontline community equally worthy of the movement's attention. But historically, Pello says those cycling through the detention system have been ignored in the environmental justice movement because they have been viewed as populations who just do not matter. Their fate is linked to ours, from the water systems that we are all drinking, to the air that we all breathe, to the land that we all live on, he told Grist, A jail wall is nothing but a wall, not much more. Indeed, patterns of incarceration lay bare the relationship between race, poverty, and pollution. We know that a history of discriminatory housing policies like redlining force people of color to undesirable and often toxic parts of cities. Today, those same communities are more likely to be over-policed and in poverty, making people of color more vulnerable to pollution and criminalization. The social and environmental harm is then intensified when members of these communities are moved out of the toxic environments in which they live and into toxic facilities where they are held against their will. Black and brown and poor white folks in prisons and jails are clearly coming from communities where they are at greater risk for these social and environmental threats, Pello said. Then they are being siphoned off, extracted, taken hostage by the state, and locked up in cages in the belly of this beast. Some research suggests that mass incarceration creates environmental harms that reach well beyond these marginalized communities. A 2020 study on how mass incarceration contributes to climate change found that increasing state-level incarceration rates between 1997 and 2016 were correlated with increases in industrial emissions and the use of toxic chemicals because of the expansion of industrial prison supply manufacturing operations.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. The first and foremost step in self-edification is that one should look at themselves and their behavior and manners with a critical eye. They should clearly and carefully observe their shortcomings and try to correct them. This can be done by us, and this responsibility is upon us. 2. Between you and God. One of the most important characteristics in self-edification, and probably the first priority, is sincerity. It means being sincere in doing something and not acting deceitfully. Sincerity in worshiping God and doing good deeds means doing it only for the sake of God. It is unfortunately common among people to talk about their good deeds, as if they are not aware that good deeds should not be bragged about. There are, of course, expectations. Some deeds should be done publicly. For example, donating in public is valued differently in Hadith than donating secretly.
رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 يا حبيب رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
Another example is congregational prayers, which are done in public, and it is part of the divine orders. But many or most prayers, those between an individual and God, such as reciting, remembering God in dhikr, prayers, spending nights in praying, and helping others, should stay between the individual and God. Be your own therapist. The best one to diagnose our shortcomings is us. Write them down. Jealousy, stinginess, malevolence. Write down when someone achieves something, it upsets us. Write about your sluggishness when working. Write about your permission about good and righteous people, negligence of responsibilities, egocentricity. We are so self-absorbed. The month of Ramadan is a great opportunity to treat these maladies as much as possible.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
The EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, updated the bloc's 27 foreign affairs ministers on the latest state of play regarding talks in Vienna to try and save the Iran nuclear deal. He told them that discussions have become less general and more focused, particularly regarding US sanctions against Iran and the Islamic Republic's nuclear energy program.
I talked with Secretary of State Blinken last week when he was in Brussels. I also talked with Minister Sharif. I think that both parts are really interested in reaching an agreement.
Borrell talks about an agreement, but critics say the EU has been much too soft on the US. After all, an agreement was reached in 2015. It was endorsed by the UN. only the US broke the terms of the accord when Donald Trump took Washington out of the deal almost 3 years ago.
With Iran, we'll see what happens.
Analysts say in those 3 years, the EU, as coordinator of the deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, failed to stand up to Trump. Representatives from Iran, Russia, China, France, Britain, Germany, and the European Commission are attempting to preserve the accord during negotiations in the Austrian capital. US officials are there on the sidelines of the talks. Given that the nuclear deal is underpinned by UN Resolution 2231, the vast majority of diplomats agree it should be respected.
We are 193 member states of the United Nations. Of course, the United States, as you've rightly pointed out, is a powerful member state, but they are a member state. And so we need to rally the numbers against those that may have different opinions.
Some citizens we've been talking to say Tel Aviv is behind efforts to derail the nuclear agreement.
Israel have interests and Israel are kind of pushing America.
Frankly, what we need is more peace and not more warmongering.
Tehran insists the only way the issue can be resolved is if Washington lifts all of its illegal sanctions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
He has imposed more tight restrictions to fight the spread of the coronavirus. Earlier, Turkish president said that the daily lockdown during the first 2 weeks of the holy month of Ramadan will start at 7 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. The lockdown will last till 5 a.m. every day, as the weekend lockdown will continue with stricter measures and more police officers present in the streets to make sure citizens and residents are abiding by the rules. During the weekend, security forces in all 81 provinces were out to make sure people are not violating the lockdown. Tourists are the only ones allowed to be outside during the lockdowns. In Istanbul alone, some 20,000 policemen took part in this campaign. Turkish Interior Minister threatened to punish those who do not respect the rules.
We will be out with our full force. Foreigners with residency permits are also subjected to restrictions and lockdowns, and they have to obey the rules just like others. I have the authority to revoke the residency permits of those who try to exploit the situation, pretending to be tourists. We will not let this happen.
The death toll in Turkey surged last month when restrictions were relaxed. Some blame the people who didn't act responsibly. Others blame the government for taking decisions based on the economic needs of the country rather than what is better for people's health. Analysts believe the government must take stricter measures. However, it is the economic situation that is preventing it from doing so.
The government is doing its best against the pandemic, but unfortunately the cases are rising because the country cannot afford full closure of businesses. Therefore, semi-closure is the only solution, and people must be more responsible.
Turkish Health Ministry said 20 million vaccine jabs have been distributed across the country. This is as Turkey says it has potentially developed a vaccine that just entered the phase of human trials. Turkish Industry and Technology Minister Mustafa Varank has volunteered for the trials. Turkish government wants to welcome tourists again after the holy month of Ramadan. However, many believe it is still too soon for this step, as only 25% of citizens have been vaccinated. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
After mass scenes of a failed security operation against thousands of protesters demanding the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan, the public resentment pitched high when the police launched operation against the protesters in the eastern city of Lahore. At the heart of public outrage is the revoking of a 6-month-old agreement by the government with Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or the TLP, a political and religious group. The TLP championed the cause to expel French ambassador over repeated incident of blaspheming of Muslim Prophet Muhammad and their official patronage by the French government. The TLP supporters allegedly attacked a police station in Lahore and kidnapped 11 policemen, including a senior official. Later on, the protesters released all the police officials. The police says an oil tanker with over 50,000 liters of fuel was also taken away by the protesters, which caused ripples within the corridors of power of its possible explosion. A strong public reaction once again forced the government to halt its security operation. There were countrywide wheel jam strike and closure of businesses after many opposition parties and other religious groups announced to support the TLP's demand to expel French ambassador.
How long we would put up with incidents?